from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn why citizens can't petition for statewide ballot initiatives and referendums here in Wisconsin. We'll speak with actor Willem Dafoe about his time as a student at UWM.
It was an adventure, but I always felt a little bit like I was an imposter, both as a student and as a, aspiring actor.
Plus, we'll have the latest Live at Lake Effect episode featuring the Wild Feathers.
We're all songwriters, so either you have a good idea or it's not so good. And if it's decent, then one of us can maybe make it a little bit better. You know, I've had a lot of ideas that were okay, and Joel or Taylor make it great, and vice versa, I hope.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Earlier this month, Governor Tony Evers announced he'll try again to allow citizen-led referendums in Wisconsin by including the change in his upcoming two-year budget proposal. This process would allow voters to directly enact policies without the legislature's approval. To help explain what a citizen-led referendum is and how it works in other states, Lake Effect's Excrit Nunez spoke with Derek Klinger, a senior staff attorney with the State Democracy Research Initiative. He begins by talking about Governor Evers' proposal.
Just unpacking his announcement a little more, he proposed adopting three forms of the citizen-led initiative and referendum power. One of these would create a petition process allowing the people to propose and approve amendments to the state constitution, basically allowing Wisconsinites to go around the legislature. Another would create a petition process allowing the people to propose and approve state laws, again, allowing the people to go around the legislature. And the third would create a petition process that would allow the people to hold an election to approve or reject laws passed by the legislature. Now, other technical and procedural details would need to be worked out to create a functioning initiative and referendum process. But broadly speaking, the proposal would create these petition processes to give people a more direct policy-making role in the state.
That's interesting. So how many other states have this citizen ballot initiative and referendum process already in place?
Yeah, so about half the states have at least one form of the initiative or referendum. And there's some real diversity within this group of states. It's not just limited to any particular region of the country, nor is this limited to like red states, blue states, or even just purple states. It's kind of a mix.
Yeah. And if it's something that's already kind of common with like half the country, why doesn't Wisconsin have a process like this already?
Well, one thing that's important to note is Wisconsin actually has a process like this at the local level in cities and villages. In state law, it's called the direct legislation process. The citizens can use a petition process to propose ordinances and resolutions. So this concept isn't entirely foreign to Wisconsin. But why doesn't Wisconsin have this at the statewide level? Well, the initiative and referendum process would require authorization in the state constitution. And I guess the short answer is the constitution has never authorized it. When the state was founded in the 1850s or a little before then, no state had adopted the citizen-led initiative and referendum power at the statewide level. So it really wasn't even up for discussion at that point. And it wasn't until the end of the 19th century, the early 20th century, that the statewide initiative and referendum caught on with states. Now, interestingly, the question to whether to amend the Constitution to allow this process was actually put to the voters in 1914, and the voters rejected it pretty handily at that. So I suspect that defeat kind of slowed any momentum behind it. Now, in the 100 or so years since then, there have been several dozen proposals in the legislature to amend the state constitution to allow the initiative and referendum, but none of them have been submitted for a vote to the people since.
Thanks for clarifying that. So what are some examples of how people in other states have used the citizen referendum process to make changes to their state laws or constitution?
Yeah, so just from the past decade or so, people in other states have used the initiative process to adopt policies like increasing the minimum wage, expanding Medicaid, limiting gerrymandering, passing campaign finance reforms, and perhaps most prominently, protecting access to abortion.
And is it common that citizen referendums pass in other states? I know you just listed a few examples, but is it common or often that this happens?
Actually, no. So if you look at all the citizen-initiated measures that have been proposed over the past, 100 or so years, only about 40% of them were approved. I think that's important to note because it shows that voters tend to approach these measures with some healthy skepticism. But just because something is on the ballot does not mean it will be approved.
Right. And so what are some reasons people support citizen-led referendums, and what are some criticisms of this process?
I think the main reason people support the initiative and referendum is that it provides a way for the people to get policies they want when their elected officials otherwise appear unresponsive to the public's concerns. And from that, others say that the initiative referendum can encourage maybe more interest and participation in the democratic process. There are a few main criticisms. Those kind of range from concerns that initiated measures might be poorly written or maybe they'll have unintended consequences. There are concerns that minority groups might be targeted or suffer from certain initiatives, or that the well-financed special interest groups might use the process to change the law to benefit them financially.
That makes sense. So if this process were brought to a statewide level here in Wisconsin, what are some proposals Wisconsinites might want to put on a ballot?
Yeah, I think if Wisconsinites had the initiative right now, we might see initiatives to increase the minimum wage, maybe to legalize medical marijuana, maybe even recreational marijuana, maybe enact gun safety measures to maybe guarantee abortion rights in the state constitution, or maybe to reform the state's redistricting process. And also don't want to forget about the veto referendum process either. Again, that's the process that would allow voters to weigh in on laws passed by the legislature. And an example that jumps out to me is Act 10 from 2011. Mm. This is the law that effectively ended collective bargaining rights for public sector unions. I would think if Wisconsin had the veto referendum in place in 2011, when that law was first enacted, you very likely would have seen that law put up for a vote by the people. And the similar thing happened in Ohio. A very similar law was passed, but in Ohio, the people have the veto referendum. And so they put that law up for a vote and rejected it.
So we've established that there's no pathway for Wisconsinites to enact or reject a new state law or amend the Constitution. But, Wisconsin voters did see 5 statewide referendum questions on their ballot last year. So how do those referendums get on a ballot?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are a few types of statewide referendums that Wisconsin voters currently can see on their ballots. This includes questions about whether to approve or reject amendments to the state constitution. Those are proposed by the Wisconsin legislature. And as you mentioned, voters saw 5 of those last year. Another type of question voters can see is called an advisory question. These basically try to take the pulse of states' voters on particular issues, but don't have any legally binding effect. Voters most recently saw one of those in April 2023, when they're asked if childless adults should be required to look for work in order to receive welfare benefits. There are a few other types of questions that are much more narrowly focused, but the bottom line is that right now only the Wisconsin legislature can put statewide referendums on the ballot.
So I'm wondering, why would lawmakers, or why do lawmakers, go through this referendum process as opposed to working it out through the legislature?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a few reasons why lawmakers might do this. Keeping in mind right now that Republicans control the legislature and that the governor is a Democrat and they might not necessarily agree on everything, the current referendum process allows legislators to get past the governor, who has the power to veto laws he disagrees with, but does not have the power to stop these referendums from going on the ballot. So it's a way for the legislature to try to get measures they support, but that the governor does not in place. But another reason is the state's courts. Even if a law has been enacted, there is the possibility that the state's courts could declare the law unconstitutional. But amending the Constitution to allow for a certain policy takes away that possibility. And just one other consideration is that these can have an impact on voter turnout. Having particular issues on the ballot might encourage people to turn out to vote who otherwise might have stayed home. But that could also be a set of citizen-led initiatives. Those can drive turnout as well.
So earlier we talked about how in other states, how often citizen referendums on the ballot pass. So how often do legislative referendums pass in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so Wisconsin voters tend to approve measures proposed by the legislature. Going all the way back to the 1850s, about 75% of all constitutional amendments proposed by the legislature have been approved by the voters.
And why do some people support Wisconsin referendum process, and what are some criticisms of it?
I think the arguments for and against this current process are probably the same, which is that the legislature serves as basically a gatekeeper for the Constitution. Supporters of the current process might point to that and say that, the legislative process to get referendums on the ballot results in better designed or more well thought out policies. Critics might point to that same gatekeeper role and say that it limits the debate to measures that are supported by the legislature, but, keeps off measures that enjoy broad support but are opposed by the legislature.
Well, looking ahead, do you know what referendums from the legislature Wisconsin voters could see next?
So one that voters will most likely see at the upcoming April 1st election is a constitutional amendment proposed by the legislature that would require voters to present a photo ID to vote. Wisconsin law already requires photo ID to vote, but this measure would add that requirement to the state constitution.
Well, Derek, thank you so much for speaking with me today and explaining the state's referendum process to me.
Yeah, thank you.
Derek Klinger is a senior staff attorney with the State Democracy Research Initiative at the University of Wisconsin Law School. He spoke with Like Effects' Excret Nunez. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll talk with actor and Wisconsin native Willem Dafoe. But first, we'll get a behind-the-scenes look at how the Mitchell Park Domes prepare their plants and what goes into making a show. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. People visit Milwaukee's Mitchell Park Domes throughout the year to see various shows. But how do these shows come to be? And how are the domes' numerous plants maintained when they're not on display? Lake Effect's Joy Powers headed to the domes to learn more with two of the experts, Horticultural Supervisor Amy Thurner and Doris Mackey, the Horticultural Services Director. We'll hear from her first.
We have six growing greenhouses in six horticulturists. So we share their horticultural staff between the conservatory and the greenhouses. They manage and operate all the permanent collections in the conservatory, the rotating exhibits, and all the crop management and growing.
Welcome to our growing greenhouses.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're in right now, we call the head house because it's the house that's in front of all the other ones. It's where we do most of the dirty work. We're going to do all the potting and the cutting back and all the major horticultural work, and then everything goes into each individual house, and they're all set at different temperatures and have different growing requirements, so you have the plants have options for what they need. We divide everything by shows or its location of where it's going to go, like either in the show dome or over at Berner Botanical Gardens. Yeah, we do a lot for them too. So,
which one of these are we going to go into first?
We're going to go in greenhouse one.
Greenhouse one. Well, that makes sense.
Okay.
Start with one.
Do you recognize these plants?
I don't know if I do.
Poinsettias. Yes, we start growing poinsettias here right around the 4th of July.
Christmas in July for us.
There's maybe six different varieties in here. The colors range from white to pink to red. They vary in size and their growing habit. Most of the pot mums, or chrysanthemums, excuse me, get pinched. And then there's a section in the back that do not get pinched and they grow straight up. So they get very tall. To grow those, we just snip off all the side buds, so and all the energy is going into that one main stalk. Those are pretty special and unique. They don't sell those at florist.
I was about to say, where do these normally go?
Yep, they all go in the show dome.
All right. This is a huge room of them. Are all of these going to go in there?
Yeah.
It's funny looking at them in this space, because I've seen them in the show domes.
Sure.
But looking at them in this space, it just seems like a vast sea of them.
It is a vast sea of them. So this is probably two installments. So some of the varieties color up sooner than others. So then we have a replacement. So think of each show almost like two shows. You know, we get a lot of visitors here in Christmas, so it's common that they might get broken and we have to replace them. So that's why we have two installments. So yeah, above our heads we have shade cloth and we have also a blackout cloth.
Right.
And the blackout cloth we use mostly on the chrysanthemum crop to trigger their flowering in time for the show, because naturally they wouldn't flower as soon as we make them flower. So it's a little trick. And we have exhaust fans in the back, and then in the middle there's two little ones that hang, and that all helps suck the air across the house for good air circulation. On this side we have what we call swamp coolers or cooling pads. It's basically greenhouse air conditioning. So there's a vent behind those that open, and the cool water trickles down, and then we're sucking that across to help these greenhouses not overheat.
Yeah.
You can come closer here, and you can hear the water,
which is operating as the cooling system for the greenhouse.
These are fascinating.
Just noticing all these tubes and how these are going to go inside the pots. This is our irrigation system. And you can see the in the poinsettias and how they're all tubed.
Oh, yeah.
So we can program the watering schedule.
So there isn't somebody, you know, walking through here with a little pot.
It's a combination, and some of that is done, but primarily we let the house do the job.
So we have a control system in here. It's called Argus. And Argus is like the main brain for all the growing greenhouses and controls all the greenhouse systems. Everything from both types of shade to the irrigation to floor heat.
So yes, the floors can be heated. So we get a little bit more warmth.
Sure. In theory, the Argus is supposed to take the place of a person physically opening the vents and physically pulling the shade and obviously the watering, but can't always be done automatically. But for the most part, we aim to do it that way just because it's more consistent and easy. And we have fertilizer. So we have all these tricks.
I'm sure with like a group like this, it's nice to have the kind of the watering system, because you can kind of set it, forget it, maybe check on the plants just to make sure there isn't a couple that are suffering. But with some of your other more less common, rarer plants, you're probably doing more of the kind of hands-on.
That's exactly pretty much how it works.
This is like you see a control panel outside of each house, which is the brain of the house.
Oh yeah.
Oh
God. Do you guys do this?
So this is if we want to tell Argus to take a break, and now we want to take control and manually operate things. That's what the little dials are for. So we may step in there and, oof, let's close the roof. It's raining and the weather sensor above didn't sense the storm coming in fast enough. And we can do those types of things. But it's rare. You pretty much let Argus roll.
It's like the weather report.
Yeah.
Usually it's pretty close, but then sometimes you're like, it's not raining. That's not accurate.
Yeah. Let's see. So there's six growing greenhouses, and 1 through 5 are the same. 6 is a little smaller, but
okay. Yeah. And so what you saw in greenhouse 1 is the holiday show crop.
Okay.
In this houses, this might be fall show. So basically the work that is being done here is 2 exhibits ahead. Right now, if you visit us in the conservatory in the show dome, you'll see the summer show. So we have a few plants here that could be our replacements. The summer show is a 13-week show, so we definitely have to replace plants. But then we're also growing for the fall and the holidays. So we're all 2 shows ahead.
So what we're looking at kind of through the door here, this is going to be probably fall
show. Yeah. soon we will actually be starting spring. Like, we're always on this roll. It never ends. So yeah, this is mostly tweed settles, or no, actually chrysanthemums, and then various annuals. No flowers yet, but soon.
Now these domes all seem pretty humid. Of course, it is incredibly humid outside.
Well, and we have this moving the cool air across.
But I'm thinking that every plant wants humidity. Do you have greenhouses where you try to keep it more arid, like the desert?
Not in the greenhouse facility side of the operation, but over on the dome side, we have a very small little room for the orchid collection, and that we have a very strong mist system in there, and orchids love to be misted. So over where we have this little orchid collection, there's a very small area where we're growing on future collections for the desert dome.
Yeah, like cacti and things.
It's our transition dome, we call it. So
these plants do take, of course, a while. As you said, you're starting some of their spring stuff already.
Yeah, soon, yeah.
But as I grow a lot of cactuses at home.
Oh, sure.
As I think about it, I go, oh, they take a long time to grow.
It's common that plants are in there. We were just talking about this a few hours ago. We had a meeting about the desert dome, and there's things in there that euphorbia right now is as big as you and I, and it's in a pot, and we're going, okay, we're ready to put you in. Now, there's not many that big, but it takes a while, so we have to have a designated space to get everything big enough. Otherwise, the plants go in, they're like so small people can't even see them, it takes time. But without the trans house, the dome side would be a lot harder to maintain that collection. That's where we have also the tropical dome. It's got some space designated in there, holiday show violas.
So these will be, these will be full plants by Christmas.
Yes.
It's interesting comparing these, just because we, of course, were in one of the greenhouses full of holiday plants, but those must take a much longer time to grow. And yet these little guys are like, oh, Day of the Dead, we'll be good by then.
Yeah.
There's another, we call it the flex house, one more space for growing outside.
Okay.
This is all the complex.
It's a really big complex.
It's huge,
I think one of the things people would be surprised by is just like
how big it is.
Yeah. And just how many plants there are back here, and like
it's a big operation.
It's an intense amount of space and an intense amount of plants.
And only two people working back
here. Two greenhouse growers.
Only two greenhouse growers?
Yes.
Oh my god.
You could have 10.
Yeah.
Doris Mackey is the Horticultural Services Director, and Amy Thurner is the Horticulture Supervisor at the Mitchell Park Domes. They both joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in 2023. Actor and Appleton, Wisconsin native Willem Dafoe stars in the recently released gothic horror movie Nosferatu. Before his extensive film career, Dafoe attended UWM in 1973 and 74. He left the school to become a part of Theater X, which started as a UWM faculty student workshop and then became an independent experimental theater company. Some of Dafoe's first acting gigs were on UWM stages. I talked with Dafoe in 2022 when he was in town to receive an honorary degree and deliver the commencement address at UWM. We met at the Main Stage Theater on campus, where he first performed as a student. So we're sitting here in the same theater, on the same stage that you performed on over 40 years ago as a UWM student. How does it feel for you to be in this space? What memory is coming back to you right now?
I'm thinking about those shows. I'm thinking about what kind of person I was in those days, about what I loved, what I hated, what I was aspiring to. I'm getting a flood of memory. Yeah, this place was, has a place in my mind and my memory. It's not lost. It's still there.
When you were first nominated for an Oscar in 1987 for Platoon, you said in this interview with Stephen Colbert that you were, quote, a dopey actor working down in a little theater. So I'm curious, what was your identity when you were here at UWM?
I was a dopey kid from Appleton who wanted to be around these people that were making theater in a university setting. And that was it, because my accent was very much on the theater department, probably to a fault. I look back on it and I took very few courses. I really jumped into production courses here and got very involved. That's not what I recommend for everybody, but for me at the time, I had ants in my pants and that's what I needed to do. So I look back on it very fondly.
So you're focusing very much on theater production. When you were working through those short-term goals?
I felt like
goals.
A little kid, also because I was 17. I hadn't yet graduated high school. I had lived in a much smaller town, Appleton, Wisconsin, about 50, 60,000 people. So Milwaukee was the big city to me. I was living, you know, couch surfing. I was living in a very hand-to-mouth way. I was taking jobs to, you know, pay for my time here. So it was an adventure, but I always felt a little bit like I was an imposter, both as a student and as a, you know, aspiring actor.
Well, even though you say, you know, you felt like an imposter, was it your dream or ultimate goal as a student that the stuff you would learn here, you know, you would take to stage or film elsewhere? Did you know that being a performer was it for you?
The beauty of being young is I didn't look that far in advance. I was just happy to be around, you know, people that I thought were interesting, that were doing interesting things. I was learning things. I had things that were being required of me that had never been required before. I was very independent. It was a whole new life. So it was very exciting. So I wasn't even thinking about career. I wasn't even thinking about what would go next. I remember even there were moments where I thought, well, if this doesn't work out, maybe I'll join the Army. Can you imagine that?
Well, you said it was challenging, you know, you're couch surfing, taking on various jobs, just trying to sustain yourself week to week. Did you have a favorite part of Milwaukee that you'd go to for escape or for comfort?
I didn't have that much free time between working and being a student, and I didn't have money. So it's not like I had this leisure time. So I did like going to the lake. I got a little nature boy in me, and that was about as good as it gets around here. I was mostly living, living and working not far from the university. I lived on Farwell for a while, Farwell Avenue. There was a bar on Downer that I used to meet friends at, and I used to go to the Downer Theater. Those
love
are my
the Downer
memories.
Theater.
Yeah, that was important because I remember that was, you know, a lot of students get exposed to foreign film or art film through film societies. Well, because I think there were so many students that weren't living here, there wasn't a strong film society that I knew of here. But the Downer picked up the slack by presenting really good programming. So I remember seeing some good art films there and some good, some beautiful things. Yeah.
So you've been in well over 100 films and have embodied so many characters. So at this point in your career, I'm curious what influences, what roles you take on. You know, are you looking for specific things, say, in a script or a type of character? How does a project pique your interest?
Director is very important. I look at the script, say, do I want to do these things? Do they interest me? There's a little bit of, would I want to see this movie? Would this be a good adventure? All those things. It's not really based on a character. Also, you want something to do. You want your feet held to the fire. You want some sort of challenge because that's going to kick it up. And fly or fail, it's going to be an experience. And that's what you look for. And you try to find the right people to do that with. That's basically it. But traditionally, a lot of actors talk about script. Script is a blueprint. it's not the most important part sometimes to me in a film. It's great to have a good story, but film is a lot more than story. It's about music, cutting, camera, light, location, tone, all these things. And also a great script that isn't realized, who cares? So I usually go with people, and as far as character, you don't know what a character is until you do it.
So speaking of character, I'm wondering on the flip side, when you're done with a project, how do you put a character to bed, so to speak? Do you have any rituals or things you like to do to reset before you move on to the next thing?
I think it, some films, some characters linger, some don't. You're activated by the camera, you know. You become that character when the circumstances that let that character come out are present. When those go away, the character tends to, you know, kind of wither away. Unless you learn something that may not be the character, but sometimes I learn something that stays with me and impacts on me and will stay with me to the next thing. But usually then that gets bumped or trumped or changed by the next thing you're doing, because there's always kind of that process of cleansing, and you don't want to go to the same well. Not as a point of pride, but it's just not as much fun to repeat things.
So you're perhaps best known for your portrayal of villains, but what is the appeal to you in playing the anti-hero?
You know, I think it depends on what films you watch. I got to make a little case in my defense. I probably play more characters that are not villains, but the more commercial movies, I tend to play villains or unsavory characters.
Are they just complex rather than villains?
Well, no, I just think that I had some success with that early in my career, and that commercially, that's I was like a go-to guy for that. Where in the independent sphere and the international film sphere, they know me from different things, and I have different opportunities there. But playing villains is fun. You get to do things that you can't do in life. You know, it's like a guilty pleasure. It exercises, you know, I'm a nice boy from Wisconsin, God-fearing and all that, so it lets me be a bad guy. There's some fun in that. It's fun to be bad. But also, I go back to this thing of whenever you play a bad guy, you got to give him his day in court. You develop the good side of him. You try to have a complex character, so you're not thinking of him being a bad guy or a good guy. Those are kind of lazy labels. And villains sometimes describe a character, and sometimes they describe, or anti-hero, as you said, mm-hmm. or antagonist, whatever you said. Sometimes that identifies how they function in the story. And sometimes I identify with those people more than the hero, because those are sometimes where the most interesting perspectives lie, because they're representing a perspective that challenges the norm, challenges the thing that we all live by. And I think that's important, even if sometimes it's a little uncomfortable or a little unsavory. It pushes us to say, what is our true nature? What is that thing that makes us go towards, you know, bad behavior?
So one of your most notable roles, and especially you've had a recent homecoming to it, was the Green Goblin. And are you familiar with the meme of Norman Osborn saying, I'm something of a scientist myself?
I am.
What do you think of that as part of your legacy?
It's fine. You know, if people have fun with stuff, I'm happy for them.
Yeah. So being a performer, you've had a pretty nomadic life too, but I'm curious, what Midwestern qualities do you think have stuck with you?
It's hard to separate Midwestern qualities from, you know, my family qualities. But since my father was born in Wisconsin, but then he was educated out east, and my mother's from Boston, still, I think I have a lot of my father's values about hard work and being self-sufficient and very kind of puritanical, work hard, strong work ethic, discipline, don't, you know, lean on anybody. Maybe that's not Wisconsin, but I associate that a little bit with how I grew up, because the community I grew up with, I always associate, through the years I've worked a lot in Germany, and I felt like it was a very Germanic culture when I was growing up. So I think that stays with me, in some ways for good, in some ways for not so good.
Well, Willem Dafoe, it's been an honor and a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
That was my 2022 conversation with actor Willem Dafoe, who attended UWM in the 1970s. Dafoe stars in the recently released horror blockbuster Nosferatu. A new season of Bulber Talk is underway, and we need some new questions from you. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break and then return with the latest episode in our Live at Lake Effect series. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Live at Lake Effect is our music series featuring artists performing in the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood. We brought the Lake Effects together, along with Visionary Studios, to showcase local and nationally touring musicians. Today, we have the Wild Feathers. The band formed in 2010 in Nashville, Tennessee, with three lead singers, Joel King, Taylor Burns, and Ricky Young. Although they're from Nashville, the Wild Feathers aren't necessarily a country band. Their sound is a blend of Southern rock, Americana roots, and Heartland pop, all centered in vocal harmony. Guitarist and mandolin player Brett Moore, along with drummer Ben Dumas, complete the band. Here's the Wild Feathers playing Stereo from their latest album, Sirens.
It comes in stereo, left and right. Every story told's got two sides. What I'm trying to say, what you wanna hear. We turn one more day into years. And I don't really know if I ever been lost or found. And I'm trying to get out like a bird tied to the ground. I should let it go, let it be. But you already know that it means. When it's said and done in the morning light, I ain't gonna run. Time to fight. And I don't really know if I ever been lost or found. And I'm trying to get out like a bird tied to the ground. It comes in stereo, left and right. Every story told, it's got two sides.
because it's stereo. Left and right, it's all we've ever known, and that's alright, because it's stereo.
Hi, this is Audrey Nowakowski from Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We're here at the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood, along with Milwaukee musician and Live at Lake Effect co-producer Trapper Shep. Hey, Trapper, how's it going?
Hello, Audrey. Hey. We have today the Wild Feathers, straight in from Nashville, delivering a beautiful blend of Southern rock and pop. And gentlemen, no surf in Nashville, correct?
We haven't found it yet. We've been looking, though.
You can probably surf behind a barge in the Cumberland, but you might hit a leg or an arm. Or
down the General Jackson.
Yeah. Would you go around and introduce yourselves?
Yeah, this is Taylor.
This is Ricky.
And this is Joel.
And together, we are the Wild Feathers.
Excellent.
That was beautiful. You did your latest album, Sirens, where there is a lot of surf. Mm-hmm. In Los Angeles, and you work with Shooter Jennings. How was that experience like?
It was great. He's obviously a well-known songwriter and musician first. And like Joel said yesterday or the day before, you know, it was kind of like for a week or two, it was like we had a sixth member, you know, so we didn't really feel like, oh, daddy's in the room. We have to like, you know, it was like, hey, is that a good idea? He's like, yeah, man, that's cool. I don't care. It's like, sweet. All right.
I heard once that while everyone else was having their morning coffee in the studio, he was having his morning beer. So the son of Waylon Jennings.
Was it him or was it us?
Because I don't know. I think we probably outdrank
him. He might have been having a morning smoke.
Yeah, he smokes. Yeah. He smokes the most pot I've ever seen in my entire life. But I didn't see him drink any beer. He left that to us.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So talking about your latest album, Sirens, is this obviously a reference of Sirens of the Ocean being drawn in? How did this theme come about?
Yeah.
I mean, you got it.
Yep, that's it. Thank you.
First one.
The album art is great, too.
Yeah, thank you. Go ahead.
Really, we just really tried to find... Titles are really hard for albums, and we really wanted something that was just one word. And I started trying to write a song called Sirens, kind of about just that, like being drawn in with all the attractive, pretty things, you know, in the music business, and then only to find your destruction. And we started kind of talking about that concept and those ideas, and like if we
speak of the devil,
for sirens.
My right
sirens.
Here.
Oh, there we go.
Perfect.
If life imitates art.
If we knew what we were, you know, kind of going into, would we still do it? And we kind of asked ourselves, and the answer was yes. So it kind of made sense.
For you guys, what are some of your biggest pointy rocks
failures
on the shore?
drug and alcohol abuse. No, it's just, you know, you don't have a normal life. You know, you're gone, or, you know, the highs are high, but the lows are low. And I think it's just got to be worth it. You have to love playing and creating music. You know, you have to love it to a certain amount to where you'll put up with everything else.
The business side is the downside.
That's the part. It's like, man, looking back, there's so many little things I wish we would have done differently. But you know, we're still here and we're still together and still getting after it. So what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
How do you make $1 million in the music industry?
Get a job.
Start with $2 million.
I was going to say work at the record label. I don't know. Yeah.
But y'all have been together quite a long time, and it seems to be a very collaborative and democratic process. Can you speak to the art of staying in harmony on the stage and off the stage?
I think the music is the easiest part. I mean, we happen to love each other and enjoy each other. You know, we're going over a decade now. We hang out when we're not on the road. We have an annual Christmas party at my house with all of us, our wives, our kids. We we genuinely love being around each other. I think that's the first thing. Because if you hate each other, it's like, I would not be doing this. I'd be at home with my family. You know what I mean? I love these guys and I love the music, so it makes it that much easier. That's my answer. I don't know.
No, I think that's true. If we didn't love each other and still like doing this, I think we would have quit a long time ago.
Yeah, I think mine is really just a laziness. I don't really, you know, I only have to sing 1/3 of the songs opposed to all of them. So, yeah, I'd be pretty, but no, we just love doing it.
Musically, it's you know, we're all songwriters, so either you have a good idea or it's not so good. And if it's decent, then one of us can maybe make it a little bit better. You know, I've had a lot of ideas that were okay, and Joel or Taylor make it great, you know, and vice versa, I hope.
No, I always feel like you make mine worse.
Yeah, yeah.
Just kidding.
As a musician myself, I always feel like I get paid to travel, not to play music.
For sure.
Y'all have been to Wisconsin many times before. I played the same day of Summerfest. What was your takeaway of that crazy county fair carnival music?
Is that where I almost broke my back?
Yeah, we've done
that
Summerfest.
That sounds about right.
At least two dozen times. I don't know.
Yeah, I dug it. You know, it's just a big old festival. I mean, we've played many things like that across the country. But we played in Madison, Wisconsin last night, and there was a bunch of people like, oh, man, I saw y'all at Summerfest for the first time with Head in the Heart. And so obviously it's good exposure, and Milwaukee's a cool town. I dig it.
Ricky almost broke his back on that show because the stage is about, I don't know, 5 or 6 feet high, and he thought, like, you can watch this on YouTube. The whole thing's on there. But he tried to jump off the stage and landed like straight as a toothpick.
Yeah.
And then it was so tall that he couldn't get back up on the stage, so he had to go around to security.
Very Spinal Tap.
And everything. Yeah.
I was free falling for so long that I extended my legs in hopes to find the ground. And when I did, I hit, and like my back just went like an accordion.
Oh. Yeah, dude.
It's like wincing in pain, but.
And that's when we were young.
Yeah.
And the show must go on.
Yeah.
So, you know, you mentioned and joked I only sing 1/3 of the song, but in talking about your partnership and collaboration, does the multi-vocal approach also translate to your writing process, or do you all bring completed songs for the rest of the group to fine-tune, or do you write a song together as well?
Both.
We do it every which way. There is times where it'll be like, oh, this will be great if another voice comes in, or like when you're in the writing process. Sometimes, I mean, just a song comes out and it's like, you know what, this is just one thing. But a lot of times when we're writing songs together, it'll be like, oh, it would be cool if you did this, and we could do, you know, you're always thinking about that. But, you know, we write songs all the time that, you know, never or aren't even for this band or for something else in Nashville. So I think that when we get in our head and there's actual like vocal parts that are like real, I don't know, obvious, then we're like, okay, this is going to be Wild Feathers type thing. Yeah.
Outside of your work with the Wild Feathers, it seems y'all keep busy with other artists. Can you talk about some of the other collaborations in Music City for the Wild Feathers?
He won't say it, but I will. But Joel is a Grammy. He didn't win the Grammy. He should have. But session bass player for Miranda Lambert, Lanny Wilson, all kinds of people in Nashville,
Hello.
The country artists. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone got a Grammy except for the actual players on the record. I have a huge problem with that. Because we could kind of claim that we're Grammy Award winning.
Yeah.
One of us
adjacent,
is.
Adjacent.
Yeah.
Sure. They said that I could like buy a some, because I think.
Plaque.
Yeah. Lanny won a whole bunch last year. But the. But yeah, some sort of like plaque or piece of paper that's framed or something. But I still have to buy it, and I was like, no thanks.
And he played bass guitar on it. I don't understand. It's so frustrating.
For a fee, you can be acknowledging to yourself.
But yeah, we do a lot of writing. We've had songs on shows and for other artists and stuff like that.
The Nashville show was a big deal. Yeah. We kind of like we really milked that show. And when it first came on, we were like, yeah, oh, show about the town we're living in. This isn't gonna be cool at all. But then, like, we put a few songs on there, and then we wrote a few songs for them, for the artists to play on there. And then we were on the show a time or two. And then, so, like, we kept on, like, just kind of, like, it's like, man, it's kind of a nice little side hustle. Money, side hustle. And then when it ended, we were like,
man, I wish you would come back.
Yeah, I know. But, and then, the Jayhawks, I think, was the most, like, proud. We wrote a song. We wrote two songs with Gary Lars from the Jayhawks, one of our favorite bands of all time, and they put it on the record. And so that was, like, a real achievement for us, you know.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Well, those artists are definitely lucky to have your talents, and we were so fortunate to have you here today. Thank you all so much.
Thanks for having us.
I don't
want to see a breakdown. I ain't gonna be a sanctuary now.
Ricky Young, Joel King, Taylor Burns, Ben DeMoss, and Brett Moore are the Wild Feathers. Be sure to head to WUWM.com and our YouTube page to watch them performing three original songs in the Lake Effect Surf Shop. Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep and myself are the executive producers of Live at Lake Effect. Sound engineering is done by WUWM's Jason Reavy, and thanks to our friends at Visionary Studios, a local advertising agency, for filming and editing this episode. WUWM's YouTube page has our past episodes of Live at Lake Effect, featuring Blitz and Trapper, Joseph Huber, Willie Carlisle, Raina, and many more. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson joins us to revisit Lake Effect's 1999 interview with then-Mayor John Norquist about housing, budgets, and public works, and compare Johnson's approach to these issues in 2025. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I ain't gonna be a sanctuary now.